From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Seen in a mirror. Looking in one of my old notebooks, I have very many. I came across two accounts of visions in a mirror. The first was told me as long ago as 1893 by Mr. Peter Hill, a septuagenarian friend of one of my Dublin tutors. I gave it as nearly as I can in his words. It is as follows. Many years ago, I accepted an invitation from my old friend Horace Bolter to spend a few days with him at Firley Hall in Yorkshire. I arrived at the house on New Year's Eve. It was a long, rambling building, dating back to the 16th century, covered all over, even to the chimneys, with ivy. It stood in a hollow and was overtopped by great trees. Viewed in the waning daylight, it looked ghostly enough, and as the carriage that had been sent to bring me from the station stopped at the front door, I was conscious of a feeling of loneliness and great depression. The feeling vanished, however, the moment that I entered the house and heard Bolter's cheerful voice greeting me. We had a jolly little dinner, after which we sat in the study and talked over old times. In the course of our conversation, I remarked that an old house like Firley Hall ought to have a ghost, and he said there was supposed to be one, but he did not know of anyone who had ever seen it. Noticing that I was looking tired after my journey, he suggested that we should go to bed. There was no gas lighting in the house, which was a long way from any town. He fetched a couple of candles and gave me one. With the other, he led the way upstairs. On arriving at the top of the main staircase, I found myself in a long corridor which was lighted in the daytime by an oriel window. Portraits of Bolter's ancestors hung on the walls and looked coldly down on me. Except for these portraits, the corridor was bare. There was no curtains to the windows and no carpeting on the floor. The air felt clammy and chilly. I had heard that Bolter was not as well off as he had been, and I thought that perhaps accounted for the house being so ill-lighted and heated. The room to which he escorted me was at the end of the corridor, close to the window, outside which long sprays of ivy were swaying in the cold night breeze. In the room, which was oak-paneled, was a four-poster bed, large enough to accommodate a dozen people, and a huge somber wardrobe, with a glass door placed opposite the old grate, in which, to my joy, a log fire crackled and blazed merrily. Bolter hoped that I would have a good night and left me. The sound of his receding footsteps down the corridor made me feel uncomfortably lonely. The room was very ghostly. I no longer felt tired and sat by the fire reading a book which I had brought with me. Gradually, I grew sleepy and presently dozed. Something woke me. The fire had burned very low, and I was about to replenish it when my eyes became riveted on the glass door of the wardrobe. It was startlingly bright and clear, and as I gazed at it, a picture gradually appeared. I saw three people standing on the bank of a river. I had no difficulty in recognizing them. They were Horace Bolter, an elderly man with white hair, and a wonderfully attractive blonde girl wearing a blue dress and glittering gold slave earrings. They were laughing and talking. Suddenly the girl gave the elderly man a push, which precipitated him into the river. Bolter seemed to be about to plunge into the river to rescue the old man, when the girl pulled them forcibly back. He regarded her with an expression of utter incredulity and awful horror. She laughed. Both people faded away, and for a moment I saw only the river. A hand then rose out of the water. The stubby fingers clutched the air frantically and sank out of sight. The mirror dulled, and I saw nothing further. Feeling decidedly eerie, I quickly undressed and got into bed. There seemed to me to be something so very ominous about the vision I had seen in the mirror that I refrained from mentioning it in the morning to Bolter. My visit speedily ended, and I returned to London. About a year after my uncanny experience at Firley Hall, I received a letter from Bolter asking me to lunch with him at the Redlaw Hotel in Mayfair. "I want you to meet my wife, Elise," he wrote. "We were married last week. She is very charming, much younger than I. I met her for the first time 3 months ago." Delighted at the prospect of seeing Bolter again, I accepted his invitation. On arriving at the Redlaw, I was introduced to Mrs. Bolter. There was no mistaking her, or the elderly man with the white hair who had been chatting with her. I had seen them both very clearly in the mirror at Firley Hall. She was wearing the gleaming gold slave earrings. I was immeasurably shocked. Mrs. Bolter eyed me anxiously and asked if I felt ill. I thanked her and said that I had not been very well lately, that I was subject to slight attacks of faintness, but that they soon passed without any serious consequences. All the time we were at lunch, I kept thinking of the scenes that I had witnessed in the mirror, and I was thankful when the meal was over. I tried to persuade myself that the visions were merely hallucinatory, but something told me all the time that they were predictive of what would really happen. I felt miserable, but what could I do? If I told Bolter what I had seen, he would either laugh and tell me I had been dreaming, or he might be extremely annoyed. So I kept my mirror visions to myself. About 18 months later, after I had lunch with Bolter at the Redlaw Hotel, I heard from him again. He was living in the south of England. "I have sold Firley Hall," he wrote. Elise did not like the house. She said it depressed her and was too gloomy. She is delighted with this place. It is certainly very attractive. I have about 3 acres of land, including a very productive kitchen garden, orchard, and a lightly sloping lawn, at the foot of which flows a fine river, in which we bathe when the weather is warm. Elise is a splendid swimmer. We have a PG, who is elderly and very well off. He is a relative of Elise. I think you met him at the Redlaw Hotel. His letter sent cold shivers of apprehension down my back. What I had seen in the mirror came vividly back to me. The lawn, the river, the elderly man with the white hair, pretty Elise with her glittering gold slave earrings, and Horace Bolter with that awful look of horror in his face. Even now, I seem to see them as I saw them so clearly portrayed in the wardrobe mirror that night at Firley Hall. It is just a year since Bolter wrote to me. I keep hoping that my fears are groundless and that the vision I saw in the mirror was but an hallucination. This ended Hill's story. The second story of a vision in a mirror was told me by Mrs. Byrne in the lounge of a White Star liner when I was crossing the Atlantic for the first time. Mrs. Byrne was staying in the summer of 1866 with her friends, the Westons, at their house in the south of England. Mr. Weston was away on business and was expected to return home very shortly. Mrs. Byrne was standing one evening at her dressing table, arranging her hair prior to descending to dinner, when she suddenly inhaled violet perfume. The air was full of it. This struck her as very odd, as she had no violet scent. Wondering whence it came, she glanced around her. She was alone in the room, and the door was shut. When she turned again to the dressing table, she was astounded to see in the mirror a lovely garden with a green summer house surmounted with a red weathercock on one side of it, and at the far end of it a pond, on which were two white swans. Standing on the edge of the pond, apparently gazing at the swans, was a tall, slender, red-haired girl. She was wearing a white dress, gold earrings, and white shoes. Stretched on the ground close to her feet was a brown dog with a bright metal collar. A little boy brandishing a pistol bounced out of the summer house. The girl gave a start and turned sharply round. She was pretty, but her beauty was somewhat marred by her extreme pallor and expression of utter misery in her large eyes. The boy pointed the pistol at her and fired. The report sounded in the room. The girl toppled backwards into the pond. The boy dropped the pistol and fled. The garden and everything in it vanished, and all Mrs. Byrne saw in the mirror was a reflection of her own white and horrified face. not knowing what to make of the glass scene she had just witnessed, whether it was just merely a hallucination or a vision produced by a supernatural agency. She finished her toilet and went down to dinner. She did not mention her strange experience to her hostess, fearing it might distress her. The following day, Mr. Weston came home, accompanied by his niece, June Power, a pretty young girl who bore startling resemblance to the girl Mrs. Burns had seen in the mirror. She too looked very sad and wretched. When June was out of the room, Mrs. Burns commented on her unhappy expression, and Mr. Weston said she had been very upset by the tragic death of her sister Daphne, who was thought to have committed suicide owing to an unfortunate love affair. She had been found one day drowned in the pond at her home. A pistol was lying on the ground near the edge of the pond. It was then that Mrs. Burns gave the Westons a detailed account of what she had seen in the mirror. They were immensely interested, and told Mrs. Byrne that her description of the garden tallied exactly with the garden of the Powers, and that she could not have described Daphne and her youngest brother, Bertie, more accurately if she had seen them in the flesh. Violet was Daphne's favorite scent, and the Powers had a dog just like the one Mrs. Byrne had seen in the glass. Mr. Weston related Mrs. Byrne's strange experience to the Powers. They at once questioned Bertie, and he eventually confessed that he had taken a pistol belonging to his brother Ronald, a youth of 20 years of age, out of the summer house, and not knowing that it was loaded, had pointed it at Daphne and fired. Although the bullet had missed her, Daphne had apparently been so startled that she had lost her balance and fallen into the pond, and being unable to swim, had been drowned. Thinking that he had killed his sister, Bertie fled, and had been too badly scared to tell anyone what had happened. So Mrs. Burns' vision in the mirror had not been just an hallucination, but a ghostly reenaction of a tragedy that had actually occurred. Some Yorkshire water hauntings. There are many rumored hauntings to the East Riding of Yorkshire. A stream between Shipsay and Hornsay is said to be haunted from time to time by the phantom of a headless woman who is seen wringing her hands as if in grief. Either she or phantom closely resembling her haunted a brook not very far from Bridlington. Within a few miles of Leven, a brook is alleged to be haunted at times by a headless figure in black, the sex of which is uncertain. According to a story in circulation some years ago, a farmer was riding by the brook one night when his horse came to an abrupt halt and stood trembling all over. He looked around him to ascertain what had frightened the animal and saw a dark figure squatting on the opposite bank of the brook. He was staring at it when it leaped over the brook and came towards him with its arms outstretched. He was horrified to see that it was headless. His horse promptly bolted and bore him along another stop till he reached his destination. He was ill for days and took care never to venture near the brook again alone when it was dark. Mrs. James, a reader of my books, told me the following experience she had when she was staying with friends in a small country town in the East Riding of Yorkshire. She was driving with one of her friends, a girl of about her own age, along a rather unfrequented road. They had arrived at a part of the road where it was very narrow, allowing only just room enough for their carriage. Dark, thickly foliaged trees fringed the sides and overhung the way, and about 40 yards ahead of them, a brook crossed the road. As they entered this part of the road, their horse suddenly halted and began to tremble in every limb, showing unmistakable signs of the most abject fear. Mrs. James' friend, who was driving, was at a loss to interpret the horse's strange behavior. She plied him with a whip, but without avail. There he stood rooted, as it were, to the soil. A thin wind whistled through the trees, and the crisp, sere leaves just began to turn yellow, rattled eerily together. Mrs. James alighted in order to lead the horse past the spot wherein was concealed something which had apparently scared him. No sooner was she out of the carriage when she heard a rustling behind her. Swiftly turning round, she perceived the tall figure of a man. "Who are you?" she exclaimed. The figure made no reply, but came silently on. She gazed at it, horribly fascinated. Its eyes were fixed and glassy. Its left hand was upon its breast, as if it was suffering from some acute pain in the region of its heart. and through the fingers it seemed as if blood was endeavoring to penetrate. So quiet, so unearthly was the extraordinary apparition that Mrs. James gazed at it, terror-stricken. When it reached the brook, it turned round and looked steadily at her with a gaze so sadly solemn that it haunted her for long after. She was still gazing at it when her friend spoke to her. She turned to answer her friend, and when she looked round again, the apparition had disappeared. Her friend had not seen it. She told Mrs. James that a man had either committed suicide or been murdered in the road many years ago, and that the road and adjoining brook had subsequently been rumored to be haunted by his ghost. Ghost Lights of the Trent. The mouth of the Trent has been rumored from time to time to be haunted by phantom lights, somewhat akin to the corpse candles of Wales. One story regarding them is this. A party of holidaymakers from Hull visited friends one day in Ackbrough, and in the evening went for a ramble with them along the river banks. The holidaymakers had come to a halt and were standing with their faces turned in the direction of the Humber when they heard a crashing sound as though some wooden things were being crushed together, and then a noise like the dragging of chains. The moon, which had hitherto been obscured, now showed itself from behind a mass of black clouds, and the spectators saw, lying at moorage, not very far from the shore, several fishing smacks. But at once arrested their attention was that, despite the intense calm, the boats were being dashed against each other in the most unaccountable manner, while the chains by which they were fastened creaked and rattled, as though they were being dragged about by powerful hands. At the same time, a peculiar moaning seemed to pervade the air. The holiday makers were commenting on the phenomena and asking one another the explanation of it, when suddenly several little blue twinkling lights were seen moving along the shore. An old fisherman from Hull, who had hitherto watched the proceedings in profound silence, now cried out in tones of the greatest excitement, "Do you see them? Do you see them? They're the dead lights, and they're not here for naught. Death, death, nothing but death. I see it all. There they are, three boats, all belonging to Hull. And in the bows of them are," here he gave a wild shriek, "John Dunn, Bert Smith, and Jem Trebbit. They're leaning over looking at us. Good God! Down goes the foremost boat with John Dunn in her. I see the black water closing over his white upturned face. Now it's Bert Smith's turn, and now Jem Trebbit. They're all gone. The waves have swallowed them up. John Burden," but before he could finish speaking, he had fallen on the ground in a dead faint. The party, who had been too impressed to utter a sound while all this was taking place, now found their voices, and after deliberating for some moments, or what they had better do, ended by carrying the old man back to the house of their friends near Ackborough, where they left him till the morning. On recovering consciousness, he emphatically declared that what he had called out was true. Those blue lights witnessed by all were dead lights, and he had seen three spirits boats go down with Dunn, Smith, and Tebbit on board them. "You mark my words," he said to his friends, "ill news will be heard of them, fellows. All three of them, mind, before long." His prophecy came true. From the morrow, there was a sudden squall at sea, and the boat containing the three men, John Dunn, Bert Smith, and Jem Tebbit, was capsized and all its occupants drowned. The Phantom Riders. Some years ago, an old woman living not far from Newstead told me a strange story. She said, "I was walking one evening close to the River Mon, a tributary of the Trent, with my dog. It was what one may describe as between the lights, neither light nor yet actually dark, and the wind was blowing so forcibly that I found it quite impossible to hold up an umbrella, although the rain was falling very fast. Struggling along, plunging first into one puddle and then another, I was skirting the park confines when I heard the strangest sound. It was something like the low moaning of the wind, but mingled with it was a distinct semblance to a voice. Indeed, as I stood still and listened to it, I certainly fancied I could distinguish actual words. What they were, however, I could not say, for it was all too incoherent. Gradually, the sound drew nearer, and then before I realized how near it was close to me, and in the dim wavering light, I saw what looked like two people on horseback, the one a man in dark clothes and the other a woman swathed from head to foot in white, ride noiselessly past me. I say noiselessly because although the moaning, whispering sound accompanied them, I could hear neither clatter of horse hoofs nor jingle of harness. This struck me as so odd that I turned and looked after them. The road was fairly straight just there, but judge of my astonishment when, after advancing some 20 or 30 yards, they made deliberately for the hedge skirting the park grounds and seemed to plunge right into it. At all events, they abruptly vanished, and when I went to the hedge and peered through it, I could see no trace of them. There was only a wide expanse of tolerably level land, with nothing on it but the dark, flickering shadows of the clouds overhead. Ghosts of the Tyne. According to periodical rumors and traditional ghost stories and legends, the Tyne would seem not only to harbor its own peculiar species of spirits, but to spread its ghostly influence throughout Tyneside, which abounds in reputed haunted houses and places. Denton Hall near Newcastle was formerly haunted by the phantom of a lady in a rustling silk dress, the ghost of a lady who was the mistress of a profligate duke. Haunted another old mansion also in the Valley of the Tyne. An avenue near South Shields and bordering on the Tyne is haunted at times by the ghost of a very beautiful woman in green, who trips daintily along the footpath and ultimately vanishes into the river with a long wailing cry. A house at North Shields, near the mouth of the Tyne, is said to be still haunted, as are several other houses in or near Newcastle, all of which are close to the Tyne. The ruins of Prudhoe Castle, overlooking the Tyne, and formerly the seat of the Umfravilles, who owned it from 1066 to 1181, when it passed into the hands of the famous family of Percy, are rumored to be haunted at times by eerie lights and sounds and vague shadowy forms. An old house and grounds near Dalton, not far from Newcastle, are alleged to be haunted intermittently by a ghost that is never seen but only heard singing. It always terrifies dogs but never cats, who seem to like it. When I stayed at Newcastle some years ago, I heard of a rumored haunting somewhere between Corbridge and Barden Mill. A Newcastle tradesman was visiting friends near Corbridge and was walking along the north bank of the Tyne one summer evening when he saw a woman in a blue dress wheeling a perambulator coming towards him. She was walking fast and appeared to be in a great hurry. As she drew nearer to him, he noticed that she was pale and seemed to be very agitated. She did not look at him but kept her eyes fixed steadily ahead. As she trod past him, he felt that there was something peculiar about her and turned to see where she went. To his astonishment, she and the perambulator had disappeared, and there was no hedge, no wall, no obstacle of any kind to conceal them from his view, only empty space and the river. When he got back to his friends, he told them about the woman, and they said that some years previously the bodies of a woman and a child had been found in the Tyne, and that ever since then the ghost of a woman in blue, wheeling a perambulator, appeared from time to time in just about the place where he had seen her that night. The River Derwent, a tributary of the Tyne, possesses a traditional folklore and legendary spirit known as the Headley Cow, which in some of the things it does is not unlike the Irish Pooka and the Scottish Water Kelpie. It can be very mischievous and in some of its pranks dangerous. A farmer named Forster, who lived in the village of Headley, near Ebchester, in the Valley of the Derwent, went into a field one morning to saddle his grey horse. After putting the saddle on what he thought was his horse and yoking the animal to a cart, the creature shook itself free, pranced gleefully about, and tore away with shrieks of laughter. The farmer realized then that it was not his horse, but the Headley or Derwent cow. Another story is about a young man of Newlands, near Ebchester, who went out one evening to meet his sweetheart, and on drawing near the trysting place, saw a girl there who he thought was her. She ran away, and the youth, thinking that she was doing it for a lark, chased her. So fast did she run, however, that he could not overtake her, and after going 2 or 3 miles, he found himself knee-deep in a bog. The girl laughed gleefully and vanished. He knew then that she was not a human being, but the headly cow, who could assume a variety of forms. On his way home, it appeared again as a girl and lured him into the Derwent. Had it not been for timely assistance, he might have been drowned. He eventually got home. The cow was often seen in the Derwent and hovering around its banks.